You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, April 23rd, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks. This is Michael Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live from our respective quarantine zones across the heartland of the United States, which is, of course, Brooklyn. On today's show, Mika Utrecht and Megan Day join us. They are co-authors of Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go from the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. What is the next phase of organizing and strategy after this major defeat? And where is there still opportunity left? Two great writers for the Jacobin magazine. U.S. jobless claims wipe out post-Great Recession employment gains as 4.4 million file for unemployment just within the last few weeks. Health Department official Dr. Rick Bright is on the out from the administration and has scorched the Trump administration's handling of the corona crisis and search for drugs. But never fear, a former Labradoodle breeder is tapped to lead the U.S. Pandemic Task Force. Not sure if that's the only thing he's ever done. Mitch McConnell, he's got an answer for all of the states that he just screwed out of aid. Gopher bankruptcy local governments, even as progressive organizations attack the absolute failure of Democratic leadership to gain any substantive wins for working people in the latest bailout round. But according to one Post headline, Nancy Pelosi is going to get hard, play it tough from now on. Starting now. Go for it. Trump says he strongly disagrees with Georgia Governor Kemp's decision to reopen businesses. Won't necessarily do anything about it. Pelosi says that Donna Shalala is staying on the Oversight Commission after Shalala's failure to disclose stock sales. It's the same job that Katie Porter wanted, who was both trained in these issues, a great advocate in Congress, and as far as we know, doesn't have stock sale issues. But why would you want her? Airstrikes hitting record highs during Corona, including in the Horn of Africa, as the U.S. empire pushes along. Caribbean leaders trying to sound the warning, trying to get some help as the United States continues to divert essential medical supplies from the Caribbean, and sanctions against Iran and Venezuela are ratcheted up. Conflicting reports out of Mexico as AMLO, by most accounts, handles the crisis well. In Argentina, the Fernandez-Kirchner government has put together a strong bailout package, but foreign creditors are trying to undermine it. And the Trump administration gives corona tracking contract to Peter Thiel's Palantir. That should make everybody feel extraordinarily safe and comfortable. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Matt, Brendan, good day. How are you guys doing?
I am okay so far. We'll see how the stream holds up today.
We'll see how the stream holds up. Let's we could just do get a little out of our system. We just, God damn it.
I hope nobody in the stream is too good at echolocation, because otherwise I think that siren that ran through me and Matt's neighborhood to yours could figure out where we lived.
Why would you give anybody ideas like that, Brendan?
I don't know.
I could actually see there's always the terrifying scenarios, but then there's also like the kind of like terrifying benign scenario where somebody's just like, yeah, I geolocated it. That's cool. Yeah, anyways, how you guys doing? I heard the siren and I went exploring. So let's start with some sound with regards to Iran. So I've talked about how the administration has not only kept very aggressive sanctions in place with Iran, they've ratcheted them up during the crisis. And Iran was actually very early to be devastated by Corona. And, you know, in a context where Iran, even outside of pandemic, there's trouble accessing cancer medications, as an example, because of the sanctions regime. It's also very important to always note that in the context specifically of the Trump administration's belligerence and aggression and warmongering, including the assassination of Soleimani against Iran, that the context is that the Trump administration pulled out of the nuclear deal, which every single organization on the planet of any repute, including the U.S. State Department, in fact, certified that Iran was following that deal to the T. So that's something to be very, very clear about. That is absolutely in an endless examples of the immense aggression, stupidity, immorality of the Trump administration. The policy towards Iran and the gutting of that deal, which is the most significant diplomatic accomplishment, certainly of the Obama administration, I would argue potentially a modern sort of modern post-Cold War diplomacy in some respects, maybe certainly of the Obama era. Opening Cuba was very significant as well. Trump obviously closed that off as well. So that's the context for Iran. Iranian ships have been engaging to some degree with U.S. naval ships, basically in a way of sort of keeping some, protecting their turf, as it were. And again, one doesn't need to be a supporter of the Iranian government to see the pretty obvious reasons, given everything that's happened in the last couple of years, let alone the broader sweep of history, why they might do that. Donald Trump has stepped forward with a response. And even in this time of Corona, a very belligerent threat.
I have to say our Surgeon General is doing a great job. Thank you. Great job. Really good. OAN.
Mr. President, thank you. Can we talk about Iran? You put out a message this morning making a rather big announcement for our military when it comes to Iranian aggression. Are you going to change formally rules of engagement for our U.S. military so that they can engage?
We're covered 100%. We don't want their gunboats surrounding our boats and traveling around our boats and having a good time. We don't want them anywhere near our boats. And so you know the order I gave. I don't think I have to say it again, but I've given that order. Under the Obama administration, it was taking place all the time. Under my administration, I gave this order early on and nothing happened. They were very nice. There was no problem. But then I noticed yesterday they did that in a much lighter form, but they did that again. I said, we're not going to stand for it. So if they do that, that's putting our ships at danger and our great crews and sailors in danger. I'm not going to let that happen. And we will. They'll shoot them out of the water.
The U.S. military does not have to change its rules of engagement in order to follow your...
Well, that's the rules of engagement. That's a threat when they get that close to our boat. And they have guns. They have very substantial weapons on those boats. But we'll shoot them out of the water. Okay.
So I just want to be really clear that what's happening now is the product entirely of the Trump administration destroying that deal. That's reality. There's a couple of other areas we could look at. In Syria, what is the Iranian role? In fact, the Iranian role and the U.S. role, theoretically are synchronized against ISIS, although obviously the United States, along with its Gulf partners, have supported groups in Syria that are very similar to ISIS. And in fact, I think the most compelling reason that the United States would even want to dislodge Assad is precisely because it's another zone that they could attack Iran from. It's an ally that they could dislodge, in the region and help undermine Iran and Hezbollah. And internationally, everybody, with regards to the last couple of years, with regards to the nuclear deal itself and to the sanctions, the Iranians are overwhelmingly supported in Europe and so on, just with regards to the specifics of the recklessness of ripping up that deal. But it's important, as we talk about multipolarity in a changing world, there's some truth to that. But the United States still has sovereign belligerent power. I mean, it's extraordinary that Donald Trump can assassinate Soleimani like that. And there really are very little consequences. I mean, Iran sort of did some strikes in response that were very calibrated. And I think potentially even through a backdoor, in some ways pre-signaled or almost pre-negotiated with the United States. But that being said, this is one of the most dangerous situations on the planet. And the Trump administration, and Mike Pompeo said a couple of weeks ago, apparently it was reported, that he saw the mass death of the coronavirus, which of course the United States was pushing by even continuing to ratchet sanctions against Iran, as a regime change opportunity. So this situation is incredibly dangerous. And it is in the main the product of the enormous aggression and recklessness of the Trump administration. And we're in a position now where they are still instigating to the point where we could actually get tripped into a war, an invasion of Iran, which would have untold, just catastrophic consequences, even in a pre-pandemic time. This is one of the nightmare scenarios for the world. And the Trump administration is pushing it. The actual answer here is to back off and stop playing colonial games, stop playing imperial games in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief break and we'll come right back with Micah Utrecht and Megan Day. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Micah Utrecht and Megan Day, two great writers for Jacobin Magazine, co-authors of the new book, Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go from the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. Guys, thanks so much for being here. And as always in these times, I hope that you're both safe and well.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. We're about as good as we can be, I guess.
Indeed. Indeed. So let me start with my only sort of how much, I mean, what could be bigger than electing the president of the United States?
That's a great question. Yes. That's a great question. Well, I think to start off with that, I mean, you are correct that actually it's a really big deal to potentially have had one of ours in the Oval Office. I think that sometimes there are some people who, in order to make a point about the insufficiency of electoral politics, will sometimes downplay how incredibly monumental that would have been.
Yes.
So point well taken. And at the same time, it's also Bernie's, when Bernie said, not me, us, the slogan that he decided to lean into, he wasn't just like flattering us. Like, he wasn't like, I love you guys, we're going to do this together, it's you and me all the way, baby. I mean, he was actually articulating a theory of change that he has had for half a century, really, ever since he was like a member of the Young People's Socialist League. In fact, if you go look, there's this archival video of him winning a seat in Congress for the first time. And the first words out of his mouth at his victory party were, just so you know, it's not going to be Bernie Sanders alone in there that's capable of making the change that we need. It's going to be all of you. And that was in like 1990 or something.
Yep.
So,
he understands that it's actually not, it has to be bigger than Bernie. And we just tried to write a book that actually spelled out what that meant beyond sort of platitudes and give a sense of the actual work that needs to be done to consolidate, cohere, and strengthen various institutional and social forces to make it possible to affect change with or without one of our people in the White House. Obviously with would have been preferable, but what can you do?
Absolutely. Then what is the, well, first of all, then let's actually, before we get to the present, maybe you guys spend a lot of time in the book, which I really appreciate. I think actually threading a very specific, important needle about Bernie Sanders that for so long, and I think actually, especially coming off of sort of Obama and, you know, just the very dysfunctional relationship built, I think, for a lot of people who came of age in the Obama era of sort of like, you know, it's one, literally the, you know, I got this meme. It's about one person who happens to be extremely cool, and that's sort of it, and that's great. And, you know, we haven't left that. I think, you know, a lot of the relationship to, you know, Pete Buttigieg and Elizabeth Warren really reflected that sort of, you know, devotion, adoration of particular individuals and brands. But then we went to this sort of like, you know, and I think was a very important course correction in some ways, like, hey, it's not about people, it's about policy. And there's some truth to that. But also, you know, policy exists in context. And I say this all as a way of saying that Bernie Sanders is flawed and has made mistakes like literally any other human being on the planet. I've actually been fairly critical of his how he's handled the bailout vote. I think there's actually legit criticisms there. But overall, this is actually an extraordinary leader who's done a hell of a lot for us and really does stick out in a very unusual and positive way. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with acknowledging that, particularly now as we think of him as a legacy figure. So can you, and I'll start with you this on this one, Mecca, talk about, Mika, can you talk about really specifically in the book how these two Sanders campaigns have really been a centerpiece of reshifting political terrain?
Yeah, I think that, well, for one thing, those of us who have been around the left for a long time know that in the past, like very recent past, the left, the socialist left in the United States, was completely marginal. We played basically zero role in the politics of this country. And that was a very bad thing for anybody who wants to, you know, live in a world of decency and dignity for the vast majority of the population. And Bernie, I mean, the reasons for that are structural, right? Like the deck is stacked against the socialist movement in the United States. We had a Red Scare whose purpose was to try to smash and destroy the socialist movement in the United States. And all of those things have created these structural barriers to the left playing a real role in U.S. politics. And Bernie is this singular individual who managed to, as you said, thread this needle of keeping those socialist politics alive while, I mean, I guess he was still a marginal figure over the years, but he managed to move from, you know, he managed to win elected office and move up the chain all the way up to the Senate. And so we have our first chapter of the book is the only chapter that's about Bernie, and we wanted to have a chapter about him because it is important to take stock of what this individual figure was able to accomplish. I mean, of course, there's plenty of objective forces that we can talk about that have led us to where we are. But the subjective forces of the Bernie Sanders campaign in particular, and Bernie Sanders as a historical political figure, are really important. I think that what probably, if you had to like guess how, you know, where new progressive left populist energies might go, if somebody had asked you about it, like, let's say 6 years ago, I think if you know the history of the United States, you know, the role that the left hasn't played, you would probably guess that what would have been most likely in 2016 would be that somebody like an Elizabeth Warren would come along. They would see that inequality is enormous, and that people are angry about it in a kind of incoherent way. And so they would try to capture some of that energy and put it into like the kind of campaign that she ran, sort of like, you know, a couple rhetorical bones, not a couple, you know, significant rhetorical bones towards the what's wrong with the power of corporations and billionaires in society. But be fundamentally arguing for what you mentioned was Obama's way of campaigning and arguing about what his role was, which is this sort of uniquely moral and, you know, competent and smart administrator who could steer the ship. And Bernie didn't argue for that. Bernie argued for a qualitatively different way of doing politics. He obviously called himself a democratic socialist, and he talked about the way that social change happened was going to come through millions of people being actually engaged in a mass movement to change things. And so I don't think we would have a reborn socialist movement in this country. We wouldn't have the reborn democratic socialists of America. We wouldn't have the kinds of, you know, the small handful but important number of left elected officials who have been elected since Bernie's first campaign. I think all of that is a can largely be attributed to the unique figure that is Bernie Sanders and the unique kind of campaign that he ran, a campaign that none of us would have expected would have ever had any real traction, I don't think, even those of us who are socialists. And not to mention like that it would not just get traction, but help spark a bunch of other things happening in American politics. So, we don't know where that's going to go, but that's the situation we're in. It's a pretty unique one, and we wanted to sort of try to tease some of that out in that chapter on Bernie, because we do think that he is a unique and important American political figure.
You guys do talk about the sort of Red Scare history in the United States, and I think also actually really importantly, and I think we do need to be extremely attentive to places that we can't cede to the right or to just sort of mainstream media narrative, frankly, conversations about Venezuela or Nicaragua or Cuba currently either. Doesn't mean we need to, you know, with all the caveats that you don't have to valorize places, but we have to be very clear that these are places struggling in the periphery who have, you know, particularly in Cuba's case, but certainly in other cases, delivered real accomplishments, and they have been hounded and are hounded aggressively and viciously to this day by the U.S. foreign policy apparatus. So, you know, Megan, I'd like to hear from both of you on this, because I think the history is really, really important, and the domestic and international. But can you both speak on the depth of the material and ideological campaign against any type of socialist idea, even let alone like real political formation? I mean, it's, you know, just even getting people to have like an adult relationship about the idea that, you know, well, you can read Marx, you could identify anywhere you want on the political spectrum, but this is an extremely, like, this is a really important thinker. You know, this is not somebody that you can have like a kind of adolescent or even pre-adolescent boogeyman relationship to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really big question. So to start with, I would say that it's important to, I guess, to acknowledge or to remember that that what Marx said, which is that the state is a tool for one class to oppress another class. And unless you have a dictatorship of the proletariat, i.e. a worker state that is in the process of oppressing the ruling class and trying to get it to no longer be the ruling class, unless you've got a situation like that going on, you have a capitalist state, which means that it is an apparatus for the capitalist class to protect its ability to continue to exploit working people and to appropriate the surplus value of their labor as profit, just to continue to profit. And it looks differently. I mean, it obviously looks differently in the Democratic Party than in the Republican Party, but both of them are loyal parties of capital. The Democratic Party's sort of theory about this is that you need to like throw people enough bones to make sure that they don't, rise up and overthrow it. And the Republican Party is a little more cavalier, you could say. But ultimately, they're both, they're both parties of capital. And in fact, one of my favorite quotes is from, I think it was a speechwriter for Richard Nixon, or possibly Ronald Reagan, who called the Democratic Party the history's second most enthusiastic party of capital. And so Bernie Sanders getting as far as he did is frankly astonishing. Like, I think a lot of people are rightfully very upset that Bernie didn't win, but I also think that we should at least pause and acknowledge that it wasn't arranged in our favor. I mean, all of the institutions of the state and all of the other semi-state institutions that surround and hover around the state are arranged to prevent precisely what Bernie Sanders was proposing happen from happening. So Bernie Sanders was proposing because he had a social democratic agenda, but the way that Bernie Sanders talked about it really was like a socialist. He was like, people are going to rise up and take what rightfully belongs to them. If there's going to be a class war in this country, it's about time the working class won that war. So even though his agenda was social democratic, it was very clear that he was hoping to use it to mobilize people towards some more distant horizon, a more distant horizon of justice and equality, right? And that's terrifying. And that's what the state is arranged to prevent, in fact. And so there was an incredible campaign against him, and it was also perfectly foreseeable. And the fact that it was successful should come as no surprise to anyone, really, because we didn't have a movement that sent Bernie up there as like an ambassador of our movement. It was actually the reverse. We try to make this point in the book, which is that if we had like drawn up plans, like a blueprint for how we would have liked for this to go, to eventually reach the point where we have a self-identified democratic socialist running for the highest office in the nation, in the beating heart of global capitalism, we would have planned it quite differently. We would have had, you know, lots more elected officials all up and down the ballot. We would have had really strong independent political institutions, ideally a political party. We would have a really strong working class institutions, like labor unions in particular. And then someone would arise organically through those ranks who we would send up there to go fight for us, represent us, right? That's not what happened. Instead, we were dormant for decades, and then out pops this guy who's like, wow, I'm really noticing that there's a lot of populist energy that seems like it could go in any direction. Would probably be good if it had some kind of left electoral expression. Here I am, happy to provide. So it's amazing that he got as far as he did. And I think we should be grateful for that. While also, I think it's perfectly acceptable to mourn the loss of, I mean, we got close. The fact that we got close was a miracle, but also like it was painful. It was painful how close we got after those first three primary states, you know.
After Nevada, you started to dream
that
wild.
That was the one. That was absolutely.
Yeah, Micah, can you talk again, just very broadly about the history of this ideological warfare that is in America's bones to some extent?
Well, it's in the bones, at least in part of the, you know, it's in the bones of the ruling class, certainly. I mean, like, right. If we want to go back to the Red Scare, it's like the Red Scare has often talked about as this period in which America just kind of lost its mind and like went irrational and was looking for a commie under every couch cushion. And we probably shouldn't let ourselves get swept up into that kind of hysteria. You know, in the future, we should learn from that. But it wasn't really irrational and hysterical. It was a campaign that was designed to marginalize socialism in American life at a time when, of course, it was playing a significant role. The Communist Party and through other left institutions had, you know, footholds in the labor movement, footholds in important institutions in American society. And capitalists don't like that. And they successfully smashed it. They, you know, got people fired from their jobs, got people sent to jail, blacklisted, all the stuff that we already know. And so that's essentially what we're, that legacy is what the Bernie campaign and the socialist movement that has been reborn through him has to reckon with and has to overcome. And it's a very tall order. The last time that somebody tried to do that and had any modicum of success was obviously in the 60s, and it's not an accident that Bernie is a product of that last time that we tried to do that. But, you know, that similarly, you know, failed for multiple reasons we could get into, and that's where, you know, things have been at for half a century until Bernie came along. And so the campaign against him and against the rebirth of that socialism, you know, the attempt to go all the way back to the Red Scare and like actually reverse that victory of the right over socialism. Obviously, they won this round in that they successfully defeated Bernie from becoming the candidate. But there is a real hope for, a cause for optimism when you see that we managed to, reverse that sort of that sense that like Americans would never go for socialism, that there is something about in Americans, bones that are fundamentally allergic to class struggle, to class rhetoric, to the idea of socialism. Like, we've seen that that's not true, that there are actually millions of people who will go for this stuff. And, it would be better to be operating on terrain in which one of ours was in the presidency, but it's also not the worst thing in the world to be newly operating on terrain in which we have found out that's no longer, that idea that Americans fundamentally hate socialism is a lie. So, we're not in the worst of possible worlds here.
Yeah, so I want to follow up on that, and then this will be the last conversation that kind of deals with where we've been at, and then we'll go into the vision for moving forward. I do wonder, and I have, I regularly speak and have the honor of interviewing a lot, particularly on TMBS. Adolf Reed Jr. is, one of my main influences. And I wonder, and again, let's just stipulate that the overwhelming reason that Bernie, there was objective variables that stopped Bernie, right? And I think that that's correct. So let's focus on the 5% that was in our hands or in the campaign's hands. And I think, one thing as an example that I always hit on was the idea of being much more clear that Joe Biden was the primary threat from early on and really having a much more realistic assessment of both that there is a fair amount of Democratic primary voters who are actually not, they certainly wouldn't be in any way opposed to a kind of anti-corporate basic populist message, but they are not very, but they're also very focused on who's, the most winnable and so on. And, I think what Reed said to me recently, which made a lot of sense, and I wonder about is when we look at the campaign, and we look at, on one hand, there was the kind of getting lost in a bunch of rabbit holes with sort of Warren supporters at times. And then there was also, in a context where there wasn't really even just that many votes there. And then I do wonder if with the rhetoric at times, and as we think about, talking about these ideas, is there a place of getting back to, as Adolf Reed says, he's like the main universal question that applies to almost everybody on earth is, do you have to work for a living? And if you answer yes, then there's a grounds for conversation that leads to a materialist solidarity driven politics. And I wonder with Bernie, and this does actually bleed out to how we organize and think about things moving forward, what is the relationship between not the substance of socialistic ideas, not the different notions of labor and what creates value and so on, but some of the rhetoric that I think is definitely appealing to an increasing number of people, but it still could be a stop for certain others. And maybe it might in some ways get us into a rhetorical fight instead of just that kind of grounded process that Reed talks about. And I think at times with Bernie, I'll confess, I was like, hey, I don't know if we're still, after you win Nevada in a landslide, maybe we have to talk about the fact that we are the leadership now of the Democratic Party. And, people should kind of get on board or not, but the tone can change. So at any rate, and I want to hear from both of you, and Micah, I'll start with you first, but what is the relationship between the substance of where we're going and the rhetorical struggles or signifiers? And sometimes, it gets really extreme. Obviously we see, there's that whole subculture on the, Twitter of, I'm an anime Maoist or whatever. I don't think that is ever going to build any type of mass coalition. And, I don't know.
Never say never, Michael.
You know what? Never say never. But when I'm being forced in a re-education camp to watch horrible anime that blows my eardrums out, and getting lectured on North Korean, governing ideology, I will definitely eat my words. But until then, I doubt very much that that's going to have any sort of mass appeal. So what is the relationship between that very clear, basic, elemental thing that Reed talks about and the rhetorical struggles around this, the rhetoric and what we can give up and what we actually need to sort of carry forward in order for the substance to be realized?
Well, I think Bernie did a decent job of weighing these things in the campaign. I mean, there is the fact that, like, you want to focus a campaign like Bernie's on a fairly focused, like, bread and butter agenda, like hone in on some key policies that you know are popular and or that you know can become more popular if you keep talking about them. And so obviously he did that with Medicare for All, the principal policy he was arguing for. He did it with public college for all. And I think public college, even to a greater extent than Medicare for All, he helped drag that from, like, definitely, a totally fringe issue that not a strong majority of people were not behind to now that being a more mainstream demand. So you have to keep your rhetoric fairly narrow and focused and not get pulled in a million directions at once, trying to satisfy sort of like every possible sort of left constituency. But you also don't, you can't like be, you know, you can't be hostile to those, you know, all of the constituencies within the left that are within the progressive movement that want you to take a stance on XYZ. And he always did that. I mean, he made the bread and butter issues really central to his campaign. And he also like brought on people from social movements and, you know, was on the right side of nearly every major political issue. He managed to do the latter without getting bogged down in, spaces that issues that would take you like too far down a rabbit hole. So some people want to talk about Bernie's campaign as like, that he somehow jettisoned all of the what some people would call sort of like fringe movement demands. He sort of shunted all those to the side. He didn't pay any attention to them and kept his focus on like what his core issues were. But I don't think that is really in keeping with what Bernie actually did. He managed to balance both at the same time, like keep eyes on the prize on something like Medicare for All, which we know is a political winner, while also speaking to the demands that various social movements have and being on the right side of them without doing so in a way that was off-putting to average people. So I don't think that we certainly can't point to that as like a reason why his campaign failed, that he was like focusing on issues other than bread and butter too much. I think he managed to do both quite well.
Yeah, I'll agree with Micah. I mean, I don't know if this is what you're actually driving at in your question, but since Micah brought it up, I think it's interesting. There are people who think that Bernie Sanders lost because he was a class reductionist, and there are people who think that Bernie Sanders lost because he was like overly woke. And I actually think that both of those people are completely wrong and were not paying attention to the race very closely, and just like had a pre-existing theory about like what ruins the left. And then when Bernie Sanders lost, they like shoehorned that theory into the situation that they're looking at right now. And neither of them is a good explanation because neither of them was particularly pronounced. I think Mike is right. I think that he managed to balance them pretty well. I mean, you can always find example of one thing or another, but did those examples, whatever you might highlight, like let's say a Bernie surrogate, like was a little like used more sort of like academic or activist-y language than is like typical to find in a working class community, or like seems distracting from bread and butter issues or whatever. Yeah, sure, you can find an example of that. Did the voters in various states like hear it and respond to it? Absolutely not. I mean, you have to have not made phone calls or knocked on doors for Bernie Sanders to think that, because there's no fucking way that those people were paying attention to what surrogates were tweeting. It's just not true. And at the same time, I think that anybody who thinks that Bernie Sanders was being like strictly class reductionist and ignoring all of the demands of various constituencies, you know, especially sort of marginalized people's constituencies, is also completely blind to the realities of the campaign as it played out. I think that Bernie Sanders incorporated, I think very gracefully, a lot of talking points specifically about how the bread and butter issues would be important to address if we care about marginalized communities, which is exactly what he should be doing. And I thought it helped us evolve as a political culture past a point we were at like a few years ago, which was a very stultifying point where there was like a major either or. And I think he helped like bring them together. So yeah, I'm getting a little frustrated personally with like people picking their thing that they think the left does too much, that they hate, and like choosing to identify that as the reason that Bernie Sanders lost. That's not true. The reason Bernie Sanders lost is because this was a structure test for the left, and unsurprising, I think, the left was actually not strong enough to beat the Democratic Party establishment and all of its capitalist class donor base, which, even though they're morons, I mean, they weren't able to actually like sit down and execute, draw up a plan and execute it. They do have enough influence to, when they are experiencing panic, pick up the phone and make enough panicked phone calls to appeal to each other's self-interest to the point where they were able to cobble together some kind of arrangement, you know, people dropping out and endorsing Biden and Obama making phone calls and so on. And they produced this result that was just impossible for us to overcome. And the media obviously played an enormous role in this as well. And that's the reason why Bernie lost, not because Bernie went too hard or too soft on a particular type of rhetoric.
Yeah, I want to move from this, but I will say, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying, but I guess what I disagree, though, to the extent that if you're running for president, there still is certain very narrow rules of politics that you actually do have to reconcile, even if you're running a really different kind of campaign. So of course it's not that like, you know, people are watching what surrogates say on Twitter, but at the same time, you actually do need to vet what surrogates are going to say before they introduce you at a rally. You do actually need to coordinate messages. There does actually need to be, and I think that to me, I mean, I actually have criticisms, frankly, on both sides, both in terms of some of the kind of overwokeness and revolutionary rhetoric. But I think the bigger concern I would have would be some of the basically just kind of like the message discipline at times. And I think that really is like you can't. There is that element of it is a different agenda. It is a different kind of campaign. It is something really special, distinct, new, positive, and transformative. And you're still doing something. You know, you can bring a totally different type of, you know, you can evolve the game of tennis, but you still have to like serve and change sides and keep score the same way. And I think that is where it starts to bleed in with, again, stuff like the message discipline. But at any rate, guys, where do we go from here? What are the opportunities, which you outline in this book? There's a lot of different options. Can you both speak to, I think, horrifically because of necessity, but in a way that is potentially very dynamic, there is a lot of labor action right now. Now, again, I don't want to romanticize this in any way because it is a product of the most craven brutality of companies like Amazon. And at the same time, people are saying no. And this is quite significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, which this was also the case, you know, in the last enormous labor upsurge. Well, what I was going to say was that in the 30s, like, right, when, you know, that was the last time that the labor really kicked off. And that was also in response, you know, to horrific conditions that people were facing, although at least they weren't facing the kind of pandemic that we're facing now. I mean, the opportunities are enormous. I mean, in the book, just the, you know, beyond the pandemic, you know, in general, post Bernie, we talk about, you know, the kind of two tracks of like social movement organizing, especially focused on the labor movement and elections. And we talk about elections. I mean, maybe this doesn't need to be stated, but like we wouldn't be having this conversation if Bernie Sanders had not run an electoral campaign. It was his decision to run for the presidency of the United States that brought us to this point where, you know, has produced all of these new opportunities. And I say that because there is this perennial debate on the left. It's like, should we do social movements or should we do elections? And Bernie's campaign showed us that like that's a kind of false choice, that you can actually do elections in a way that can help lead to all kinds of new, you know, labor movement energy and sort of organizing, grassroots organizing energy. So, you know, we talk about, you know, in the election section, I mean, we have some kind of principles. Maybe Megan, if you want to explain that kind of the argument for a class struggle electoral strategy for how we go about our elections.
Yeah, so in 2019 at the National Convention of the Democratic Socialists of America, there was a resolution that was submitted and passed to commit ourselves to a strategy called class struggle elections. It's basically trying to narrow down what DSA thinks are like elections worth engaging in, because everybody in DSA will tell you like, look, we understand that the electoralism is a phenomenon and it's historically a problem for the socialist left, thinking that you can actually just kind of like elect your way into transformative change is an issue. And then of course, abstentionism is also a problem, because if you just sit on the sidelines and snicker at all the stupid people going up there and attempting to make change at the ballot box, I mean, you're essentially just ceding that territory, that extremely important territory, to your opponents, and also not meeting people in the space where they're thinking about politics, because like it or not, that's where people put their political energies, right, is in the electoral sphere. So to reconcile that problem, DSA has been trying to come up with some criteria for what would be a good election to participate in. And so we passed this resolution on class struggle elections, which contains some guidelines. And then Micah and I just wanted to flesh it out. Like, we wrote this chapter of the book, and then we wrote a second chapter with examples to try to like really demonstrate what we think differentiates a normal election, even a normal election by a progressive who might agree with us on some policy stuff, from a class struggle election, which is an election that exists to actually heighten the level of class struggle. And the three criteria that we came up with were: one, raise the expectations of the working class. There are a lot of ways you can do this. Rhetoric is certainly one of them, but platform is really significant. Think about Bernie and Medicare for All. It wasn't poll tested. It wasn't like people wanted universal health care, but that's like vague. He was like, here's a policy that's not popular, and I'm going to put it forward, and I'm going to raise your expectations for what you can reasonably deserve from a functioning society as a working class person, and was enormously successful in this regard.
You know, we quote the AOC. AOC from when she was at the Queen's rally for Bernie, where she says, when Bernie's first campaign started, I was working as a bartender and I did not believe that I deserved healthcare. And like Bernie Sanders convinced me that I do deserve healthcare, which to me is like one of the most powerful moments to come out of the campaign, is a real testament to exactly what we're talking about with raising expectations. Like, Bernie Sanders is campaigning on Medicare for All, made millions of people believe that they deserve Medicare for All.
Right. Right.
I listened, and I just want to add as a note to that I listened to the symposium that you did with several people, including Adolf Reed, and he made a really good point about how we also have to acknowledge that's not necessarily permanent. Like, we've raised expectations, and like that can be wiped away in an instant. It can be a sort of like a period in the past where people were more open to this idea if we don't capitalize on it, which is why the other two are really important, the other two criteria. The second one being to polarize along class lines very explicitly. And the way that we explain it is this: the Republicans are very good at division, and the Democrats are very good at false harmony. So the Republicans will be like, you should hate your neighbor because your neighbor is an immigrant. And the Democrats will be like, don't hate anyone. And in fact, don't hate Blue Cross Blue Shield, even though they're denying your medical claims.
Right.
You know, like it's,
it's a big country. It involves undocumented people and the people that won't pay for your kids' inhaler all coming together.
Right, exactly. So like what we're proposing is a form of unity slash division that kind of takes the best elements of both. Like, yeah, we don't want false harmony. There are in fact interests in society that are diametrically opposed to one another, and specifically class interests, and we're going to make that extremely explicit. And at the same time, we are going to promote unity among the vast majority of society, are going to be unified across lines of difference against those people who they're most different from.
Right.
And those corporate actors that they're most different from. So that is like a central, if a campaign isn't doing that or isn't willing to do that, or if the candidate demonstrates that they don't actually have that grasp, then that it's probably not going to rise to the level of a class struggle electoral campaign. And
so can I just say real, just to fill it in? I mean, and I don't want to look a lot of different folks approaching politics different ways in this audience, but I'd say, like, you know, Andrew Romanoff, certainly if I lived in Colorado, I'd vote for him. I think he's actually, you know, I'm certainly glad it's going to be him instead of Hickenlooper. He's got some good progressive positions. If you want to volunteer, great. I'm in no way discounting that. But by this model, cool, go vote for him. That's a better person to have in the Senate. Keeping Rashida Tlaib in the House has class implications.
Say,
you know, I always hesitate to do this because you're always inevitably leaving people out. But let's just say, because it's the leadership, Michaela Wilkes taking on Steny Hoyer and Shahid Buttar taking on Nancy Pelosi, explicitly identifying a serious class base of why they're taking on these Democratic leaders that have done so much for corporate America and harmed the working class so much, frankly. That's kind of the dynamic we're looking at.
Yes, exactly. I think that's exactly right. And then the third criteria actually helps, because you could end up with a list similar to yours, but you could still be missing this fundamental characteristic, which is, like, you could have a great candidate, but they could sort of be coming out of the ether and representing only themselves. And maybe they actually have the right viewpoint, but they don't have a connection to an organic working class base. They don't have a constituency. They're not interested in building one, and they wouldn't necessarily be accountable to one. I mean, just structurally speaking, even if they had a golden heart, they just wouldn't be accountable to a working class constituency, because they don't come from a working class constituency, or they don't have relationships to organizations that represent either the working class itself, like unions at their jobs, you know, or represents something like DSA, which is, you know, a pro-worker organization with, like, a very pro-worker ideology. So this third one is the idea of building movements and being able to sense a commitment to building and strengthening movements in a candidate, which sounds really vague, but we try to spell it out in the book precisely what we mean about that. And then the way that the campaign is run also needs to be building movements in the process of running the campaign. And we gave some, like, illustrative examples of what that looks like in the book. The one that probably is easiest to digest being in Oakland, the East Bay, where we ran a Democratic Socialist for the state assembly and we lost, but the infrastructure that we built up in that campaign, we turned on a dime to apply to a labor solidarity campaign for the Oakland teacher strike. So instead of dissolving the campaign infrastructure, we basically just sprung it into action and in a non-electoral sphere. And, like, that's kind of what we're talking about in terms of building a campaign that actually has the capacity and the interest to do that sort of thing. So those are our three criteria. I could go on forever about it, but I'll stop. And then there's labor stuff, which Micah can talk about.
Yeah, let's get, and I'll just add one more, another Adolph Reed, which is the idea of the relay race, which is, you run your part. The main action has been the Bernie campaign. It didn't succeed, but it generated an enormous amount of literally trained people. There's all of these things. And then you go and you pass it, you know, like a relay race. Micah, please, specifically on the labor component, if you can, in the last couple of minutes.
Yeah, so labor is obviously completely it is so critical to be building up. I mean, one of the lessons that we should take from the Bernie campaign is that, like, we may have this reborn socialist movement that is inspiring that we're a part of, but we can't just do this on our own as a new socialist movement. Like, we actually really suffered because we have a really weak labor movement right now. And we don't have enough people within that labor movement who are willing to take stances like, you know, fight for an endorsement of Bernie Sanders. Like, so on the electoral level, the weakening of labor, I think that was a really critical part of what went wrong, with why we're unable to get Bernie's to victory. But beyond elections, the labor movement is the central institution that we need to be building if we're going to have a robust working class movement and a robust left. And you know, Bernie used his campaign to not just, you know, talk about the importance of workers, but used his campaign infrastructure to turn people out to picket lines. Megan has a great section. I think the conclusion of the book where we talk about that Brooklyn rally where Bernie brings up the president of the United Electrical Workers local, who's talking about the strike that they were waging in Pennsylvania, and the whole crowd is chanting like strike, 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 yep. You know,
13,000 people chanting strike. You've never seen anything like it. It's crazy.
I lost my voice at that one.
Whenever you get the chance to chant strike with 13,000 people, you got to do it at the top of your
That's
lungs.
Right.
So rebuilding the labor movement.
Bernie came out to Santa Gold. There was a lot of energy at that one. Yeah.
So that rebuilding of the labor movement is critical. And that's something, I mean, Megan and I were on a call the other night where with the members of the Young Democratic Socialists of America, I think, who asked us kind of tongue in cheek, like, how do we create the next AOC? And like, that's an important question to ask, but also people should be, you know, just as important as whoever the next AOC is going to be is like, who are the next rank and file teachers who are going to go on strike? Who are the next people who are going to take from the energy from the Bernie campaign to go and rebuild the labor movement? To you know, whether as, you know, rank and file workers, especially, you know, socialists and others who are class struggle minded, who are going to go into their unions and transform them into democratic and militant bodies, that can have enormous, you know, I live in Chicago where like the Chicago Teachers Union, it through its willingness to do that has totally reshaped the politics of the entire city. That is a central task for people who are inspired by Bernie going forward. To take the energy from the campaign and use it to rebuild a labor movement. If we're going to actually have a chance to not, you know, not just like go on strike and do all the things that we know that are needed to be done in order to rebuild working class power, but also win an election with whoever the next, you know, standard bearer of the left is who's running on a presidential level or whatever, we're going to need a rebuilt, you know, strong democratic militant labor movement in order to do it. So that's a central task going forward.
Absolutely. Well, guys, I really appreciate both of you so much. The book is Bigger Than Bernie, How We Go From the Sanders Campaign to Democratic Socialism. You can find, of course, Micah and Megan's work at Jacobin and every other place where you can read and listen to and watch good things. Appreciate you guys. Thanks so much. Stay
thanks
safe.
So
stay
much
healthy.
For having us on. Yeah, you us too. On. Thanks a lot. Catch you later.
All right. Is our stream still good, guys? Are we actually still up?
We are.
Wow.
God bless.
Yeah, let.
Micah's gone. I'm still here for some reason. How's it going?
I'm glad you know. I'm glad she. I was about to actually say, hey, you want to hang out on the fun half with us? And go for it. Come on. Okay, but we're going to take a break.
We'll do plugs first.
Sure. Okay, so Michael Brooks' show yesterday, on Tuesday, we had Dr. Cornel West. Matt, how did you feel about the interview with Dr. West?
Oh, I think it was, an all-timer, definitely. It was, he gave us an hour plus of his time. He dropped a whole bunch of literary references that I appreciated, like Sinclair Lewis and Richard Slotkin. Yep. He's the sort of guy that it'd be impossible to, like, we occasionally have people on where like Bernie or like Slava, where you think, is it Michael doing an impression? But Cornell's impossible because nobody has like the breadth, I think, of like his reference is just so insane. Like the way he goes into Greek tragedy after you tell him like a dumb story or something like that. I can't really remember what his
reference is. Tell him a dumb story.
Well, like a story about modern politics being dumb, basically.
No, I told him, what I loved is, it's actually a really compelling quote, which is Fernando Flores, who's this Chilean.
Oh, right.
Chilean philosopher. He's a business management consultant who is Allende's finance minister, actually. And the quote is, "Hope is the raw material of losers." And I just knew I wanted to tell Cornell that quote. And then he connected that to Thucydides, which is exactly why I wanted to tell him that quote. Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, not Thucydides. I just knew it would go somewhere. I didn't know it would go to Thucydides, to be clear. But yeah, it was an incredible interview. One of the best pieces of feedback I got on it that somebody wrote to me, and he's like, "Look, I'm a huge fan of Dr. West. I've been reading while following him for years. And, you know, like with any of these, you know, like he's like, I you know, I know his moves, you know, and I always want to listen to him. And I heard, because of the question in the interview, a bunch of new things," which is amazing. Like that was awesome to just think that like there was an opportunity because of the format to go in broader directions and just really fill out just like what an incredible mind and incredible spirit the guy has. Obviously he's a hero of mine. So anyways, check that out. Tonight we're streaming about Brazil and Latin America with Brian Mir. Friday we're doing a show with Stephen Cook about the geopolitics of the oil crash. And then on Sunday we're doing our new economic series with Mark Blythe. Last Sunday we had on Grace Blakely. And I would go and obviously support all of the massive additional public content we're doing. And then still we're doing a lot of patron episodes. There's a great illicit history of South Carolina Labor Party with Adolph Reed Jr. We just did patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. And also it's going to be released tomorrow. You can, and people are already getting it in the mail. Go to Red Emma's and get a copy of Against the Web, The Cosmopolitan Answer to New Right, which in the words of Cornell West is a marvelous text. Jamie.
Oh, you guys hear me?
Yep.
All right. So this week on the Antifada, we had a Twitch stream on Monday 4/20 to celebrate the release of Andy's new book on Jay Posadas. That is still up for anyone who wants to watch it, or at least most of it is. Also, today we have unlocked our Real Posadist Hours with special guest Comrade Communicator, previously only available to patrons. We read a previously unpublished work by Jay Posadas called On the Function of the Joke and Irony in History from 1976. And as it turns out, Posadas was not a big fan of humor or irony, which is itself ironic because he exists today largely in memes about space dolphin communism. So he would not be very happy about that. But yeah, check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Oh, also Friday, that's tomorrow, I have a new episode of The Vampire Castle coming out, wherein I talk about vampire stuff with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session. And this one is about the TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And we both really, it's close to our hearts. So I think it's a good episode. Check it out. That's all. That's all I got for now.
Matt.
Yeah, twitch.tv/literary hangover. I streamed for over 2 hours last night without a single drop in frame from my ISP. So I don't know what's going on with during the daytime, but twitch.tv/literary hangover. I did a Plague's Tale Innocence while listening to Daniel Defoe's A Journal from the Plague Year, a 1722 a fictitious journal about the 1666 plague. A lot of relevancy, actually, you'll find. Some things don't change, folks. Anyway, subscribe. That's where I'm pushing people now. Subscribe at twitch.tv/literary hangover.
Sweet. And also, of course, on Patreon.
I forgot one. Can I say one more thing? I'm sorry.
Sure.
I keep forgetting to plug it because I'm not on every day. But Red May is a month long of leftist programming that usually happens in Seattle. Andy and I had our flights all booked and then they had to cancel it, but it's still happening virtually. So on May 6th, I can put a link to it in the description for anyone who's interested. Andy and I will be moderating a panel on coronavirus and the future of work.
Dope. And of course, new show, third episode Saturday for the Jacobin Channel, Anna Kasparian and I, Weekends with Anna Kasparian and Michael Brooks. Brianna Joy Gray is joining us. Last 2 weeks, we had on David Sirota and Aaron Bastani. We're having a lot of fun, and Jacobin is just massive amount of the teaching content, including the panel I did with Adolf Reed, Willie Leggett, and Cedric Johnson, and one's on Gramsci, one's on, I mean, it just tons of stuff. Go there, subscribe, check out our new weekend show. Lots for you to watch while you are hopefully quarantining. All right, folks, we'll see you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.